We will call the Senate Health and Human Services Finance Division to order for Wednesday, January 30th. We have an incredibly full agenda today. This is an annual tradition around this place where we finish the governor's and the administration's presentation of their budget, and then we open it up to public testimony. Just to let folks know ahead of time, we have 21 testifiers on the agenda today, many of whom came from long distances and are unable to come back tomorrow. So we are going to try to hold people to fairly tight timelines. I think there's about 4 or 5 minutes available for each and every person, and hopefully we can be respectful of everybody else. Also, assure people that as the governor himself states, this is a starting place, not an ending place. So this is first blush. We're going to see much more about these proposals and have much more in-depth conversations about each and every one of them as the legislature unfolds. With that, we will try to finish up the presentation of the governor's budget proposals with Jerry Kerber, OIG, the Office of the Inspector General within DHS, and we're going to try to finish this up by 9 or 9:15, but we do have some items that may need some discussion. I want to encourage members to have that discussion, but we should be efficient with it so that we can get to the public testimony in time to give everybody their chance at the microphone and let us know their initial thoughts on the budget. So with that, Mr. Kerber, welcome back to the committee. Thank you for returning from yesterday, and try to help orient the members as to where we are on your budget pages so that we can follow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the Inspector General of the Department of Human Services. And so I'm going to continue where we left off yesterday. but in sort of the interest in time, I'm going to be more brief because I can come back and explain this stuff to you anytime. And as you mentioned, there are other people who came to testify. So I think what I will do is very quickly talk about a couple of items, and then I want to spend a little bit more time on the on the proposal that we have that's related to child care licensing changes, that's in response to a report that was distributed by a mortality review panel. And so maybe I will get through a couple of these really quick in light of other people maybe coming yet before we get to that one, if that's okay, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So the one that we didn't get to yesterday that's more in the program integrity area of our function is related to requesting some resources. Oh, and this is number, it's Fast Fact number 63. And on your pages here, it's on page 24. And what we're looking for here is some resources to do some more investigations. And just a little background, we have about $418 million is spent on child care through the CCAP program, Child Care Assistance Program, in the next biennium. There's 12,500 providers who are enrolled to receive payments for child care services for more than 19,000 Minnesota families. In November of 2012, however, there were 6,178 families on the basic sliding fee waiting list. And so there's more of a need for this service than is available. So over the years, what our licensing staff have observed is that there may very well be some fraudulent activity going on by providers, and I know it's a strong word to use, but that's what our observations have been. There have been many benefits to this new combined office of the Inspector General that has taken licensing functions and paired them within the same organizational structure with the fraud investigation functions. But one of the things that's surprising about this is that in this program, there really is nobody who has the responsibility or the clear authority to investigate alleged overpayment issues when child care providers are involved. We have a system that investigates alleged overpayments involving recipients who may misrepresent their eligibility while they're applying. That system is in place, but we don't have anything in place when there's a suspicion that there may be a child care provider who's engaged in some activity. What we have done over time is try to enlist the help of criminal investigators but it doesn't always rise to that level. So what we're trying to do here is to establish an administrative investigative function within our agency that's going to investigate these allegations. And I just might alert you to a fact that there's a mistake on the spreadsheet. This is actually going to be a moneymaker for the department.
I was going to ask you about that, as all of these items, I'm hoping to see some of the savings.
Yes.
On the fast facts as well, in the impact, it says that projected program savings and recoveries can in part be reinvested in the program. That would have to come through the legislature to reinvest, right? I mean, I'd like to see the savings on our books first and make decisions about how to best invest savings.
Mr. Chair, it gets a little complicated.
Okay.
I'm just going to ask Vicki Kuhnert to come up. Kuhnert is Deputy Inspector General in that area. And I think depending on which program is at stake here,
some
the money is handled
are
a little bit differently.
Okay. Yep.
Mr. Chair, in the fiscal note, we projected half the savings that we expect to earn because in statute, revenue recaptured, collected, for the basic sliding fee returns to that fund if there is a deficit. And as Jerry Kerber mentioned, there is a waiting list. And so we only could project half the revenue to the general fund that we expect to get from our investigations because of the statute provision protecting the basic sliding fee.
Okay. Okay. That makes sense. Now, you said there was an error on the spreadsheet. Maybe you could.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, this is page 9 of 10 on the spreadsheet that
distributed yesterday. It's the first document in members' books if they want to try to correct it. I know I'm going to, I guess.
On page 9, and this is going to be, this is being corrected, of course. It's line 151 for fiscal year 2017. It shows that there's a $43,000 cost.
Mm-hmm.
And that is actually going to be $128,000 the other direction.
In revenue.
Thank you. And we'll get that updated spreadsheet when it's available, I take it.
Okay, Mr. Chair, moving on to the next item here. I'll just say very briefly that we do have a fee proposal in for the redesign of the home and community-based waiver system, the oversight system. I think you heard
tell us
some
on
about
what
that
page we're.
Oh, this is the it's the fast fact page 53, and on your other document it's on page 23. And this involves the department's response to a 2007 determination by CMS that our system of oversight of home and community-based waivers services and the funding of them needed correction. And largely that was based on inconsistencies that were discovered throughout the county contracting system where there were services and rates determined on a case-by-case basis. They said that people really had more of a need to have more consistent access to the same services in this federal program. There's 32,000 people receiving services, and what's being done here is there's sort of a redesign of the whole oversight process where waiver services, as we refer to them, under DD, the DD waiver, have been licensed by the department for many years, going back to the early 90s. However, the services provided under the other waivers have not been licensed. This proposal is going to move all of these services together to be licensed under one single set of licensing standards. And we're doing some other things that providers have talked about an interest in, like one license that applies to the whole state. And certainly I'm anticipating we'll be talking in much more detail about this over time. So, but we came up with a licensing fee scheme here that we think is reasonably fair, and it's based on a survey we did of providers where understandably they got to pick from a variety of choices that may not all have been, you know, desirable, but at least there was a ranking order of the different options that we were thinking about at the time. And just a little ballpark here. There are going to be about 1,600 providers who are affected by this. 950 of them will be licensed for the first time. So 950 of them is going to be a new relationship with us. 650 currently hold a license to provide DD services right now. And there's 140 of them that hold a health department home health agency license. And we're working very closely with the health department. And my understanding is you're going to hear about a home care revision proposal of theirs, too. And we are right together on this effort and trying to figure out how are we going to make sure that providers only deal with one agency and wherever possible they can have one license that does it all. So Mr. Chair, I'll move on if there are no further questions about that. Okay, Mr. Chair, that leaves me with the child care licensing changes that have been have gotten a fair amount of attention, and I'm assuming you've received a lot of comments. This whole effort began at the end of two.
In members' packets are some of the testimony that we've received via email and asked that it be distributed. So if people want to read that as we go along, and I'm certain people will come to the mic today as well.
Yeah, and this is fast fact number 57, and it's on page 23.
Okay.
At the end of 2011, we did a year-end report, and it was our new commissioner, Jessen, had asked for us to do a report to summarize the licensing activity and identify any trends that we were seeing. Through that activity, we discovered a couple of things that were pretty alarming to us. One was that we were issuing an awful lot of temporary immediate suspensions to family child care providers based on, which is the standard is that there's imminent risk of harm to children. And that of the 95 that we issued in 2011, 8 of them involved infant deaths. And so the deaths kind of jumped out at us. And so we went back and looked and saw that there was a change in the average number of deaths that we were seeing per year in family child care settings. There had been an average of 6 per year prior to 2006, and now there were more than 11 per year in 2010 and 11. And in the first 4 months of 2012, we had already had 6 infant deaths in family child care. And so, you know, we thought something must be going on here. Further review, we looked at the 2 5-year blocks and saw that from 2002 to 2006, there were 26 deaths in total. 25 of them were in family child care, 1 in a center. And in 2007 to 2011, the next block, there were 51 deaths. So we had 26 increased to 51 in 2 5-year periods. And then in 2012, as we're kind of collecting these numbers, we had 9 deaths already by the end of July. And so after July 1st, I'm happy to report, we had a long gap where there were no deaths until a recent one, unfortunately. So we had a total of 86 deaths over this 10-year period, and 83 of them were in family child care situations. And trying to put that in perspective is a challenge, but one way is to look at child care centers. On any given day, there may be 60,000 children receiving child care center services. At the same time, on any given day, there's about 90,000 kids in family child care. And so there's 1.5 times as many children getting care in family child care as child care centers. But when you look at the numbers, there was a 28 times more incidence of death in family child care than there was in child care centers. And, you know, so 1.5 times and 28 times is you know, some of these numbers were just jumping out at us, and we thought there's something we need to do. There are many different ways to analyze this data, and there is certainly more analysis that can be done. People are questioning, well, maybe there's something, maybe the kids that are in family child care are sort of a different characteristic than kids in child care centers, and that very well may be. When we're talking about infant deaths, we know that there are other risk factors that occur in the homes. And so maybe kids in family child care are more likely to come from homes where there are other risk factors present than children who go to child care centers. We don't know that. But to address that, we've asked the health department's epidemiology folks to take a look at that and do a review to see if there are some other factors at play here. But And another thing we didn't look at, and you may hear some testimony about this, is we didn't break those numbers down to actual infants in care. When I'm talking about, there's 1.5 times as many kids in child care, in family child care compared to child care centers. I can't tell you today how many of those were infants. You know, what's the infant ratio? You know, we don't know that. And we also, you know, there's a number of things we don't know. So, but the numbers themselves, the number of the deaths, seem to be quite alarming in that of the 83 children who died in family child care, 75% of them were found to be in an unsafe sleep condition related to that death. 75%. So 65 of the 83 deaths that occurred were in an unsafe sleep arrangement. So our focus needed to be on the safe sleep arrangements and how do we get better compliance of that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Clausen.
Just a question. Other than licensing requirements and additional insurance, will there be actual home inspections of these facilities?
Mr. Chair and Senator Clausen, yes. When I get to the proposals here, there are some things that we're proposing and some things that were recommended that we're not proposing. And when it comes to the inspections and increasing the rate of inspections, that's probably one of the most expensive things that can be done. And so it's not to say that that's not a good idea. Certainly we know that in the past there were annual licensing inspections of family child care, and we did annual licensing inspections of child care centers as well. But as budget reductions have had their impact, and the law has been changed to allow for those inspections to occur every other year, that's not to say that there aren't more visits to these sites. Certainly complaints get investigated and things of that nature. But that certainly is an issue. And one of the things that we talked about in here, and it's not shown in any of the proposals because we haven't really kind of figured it out yet, is how do we get parents more involved in sort of ongoing monitoring and educating them about what the standards ought to be so that they can be eyes and ears of the regulators, perhaps. And to get parents to actually have different conversations than they may be having now. One of the side effects of all the publicity to this infant death is that there's a lot of people talking about infants dying in family child care that didn't before. And all of those conversations are good. Because they've raised the awareness. And maybe that had something to do with there being no deaths in the second 6 months of 2012. We don't know. But certainly the heightened awareness by parents and providers and everybody, we think it's going to have to play a significant role here. But so we're not proposing more visits at this point. And one of the things we're also not doing is we're not really focused on SIDS per se. You know, SIDS is a medical diagnosis related to an unknown cause of death. What we're really looking at and trying to focus on is the safe sleep practices by the provider. There are too many of these cases where infants have died where they were in violation of the safe sleep requirements. We know that from the research that there are some of these factors seem to reduce the likelihood of SIDS. I mean, they're labeled SIDS reduction requirements for that reason, that they seem to be associated with even an increased SIDS incidence of SIDS deaths when infants are sleeping in cribs in unsafe conditions. But it isn't SIDS itself that we're targeting here. But so one of the things that we had done is we asked a child mortality review panel to take a look at this situation. And their report is what has raised a lot of attention. The Child Mortality Review Panel has been meeting since, I think, like 1990 or so, quarterly. And what their mission is to review infant deaths or child deaths in Minnesota. And it's the deaths of children that occur in any kind of licensed program, but also the deaths that are related to, they're in a family that's somehow involved in the child protection system. And so if there's a family that's getting child protective services and they have a death of a child in their home, it gets reviewed. Similarly, if Child Protection does an investigation and finds that even though somebody had no contact with the system before, the death appeared to be related to possible child maltreatment, then the panel reviews it. And so each of these deaths had been reviewed by them individually, but what we asked them to do is to go back and take a look at these deaths now collectively and see if there were any trends that they could see and see if there were any recommendations that they could come up with related to family child care licensing standards. And so that was the report that was issued, I think it was October or so, that a lot of people read. It was widely publicized, and I'm sure you got some reactions to it. Some of the reactions were some people assumed that the report, the recommendations in the report were now in force, that we would start enforcing those. Some perceived those recommendations to be our department's recommendations to the legislature, and some others saw it correctly, that there was an independent panel that was making recommendations to our commissioner that would be evaluated, and then we would hence make recommendations to the legislature about what should be changed. So in this whole process, after that report came out, we started getting a lot of feedback too. And so we certainly wanted to put together the best list of recommendations for statutory changes that we could come up with. And so what we wanted to do is elicit the input from providers. We had community meetings, three of them around the state, one in Rochester, one in St. Cloud, and one in St. Paul. We had meetings with parents. The commissioner and I met with the parents of an infant who had died on his eighth day in family child care, found with his face in a pillow. We heard a lot of stories and we got a lot of advice, and we got some incredibly valuable feedback. And one of the things one of the bits of feedback is that I was cautioned on how I talk about family child care, because I don't want anybody to get the impression that there's necessarily a widespread problem in family child care. There isn't. Most of the people we heard from, parents we heard from, said that they just love their family child care provider, and it's the most wonderful thing in their lives. They consider them to be an extension of their families, they're very warm, nurturing environments. And so this is not to be construed that there's something categorically wrong with family child care. And so it also is important to note that our focus, we tried to stay fairly laser focused on this infant death issue, rather than going down the road of looking at, there are people who are interested in making some changes to make overall enhancements to the quality of family child care, to raise it up to more national standards and things like that. Keeping our focus here was important because we're recognizing that a lot of people in Minnesota are priced out of child care centers, and family child care is not only their choice, but it's also what they can afford. And so some of the recommendations in the report, like that we significantly lower the ratios and we lower the capacities of licensed care, we didn't go that way. And we didn't go that way just because it would be too costly, but we also didn't see necessarily the nexus between the deaths that were occurring and that issue. I think there was a statistic that 10% of the deaths occurred during times when the provider was out of compliance with the capacity limits. But being out of compliance with capacity limits, to me, doesn't strike as a reason to change the capacity limits. I mean, it's a compliance issue. And so we tried to focus on those compliance issues, and particularly those that are most related to the infant deaths. So that said, just a brief segue about the oversight situation that maybe not everybody understands. All licenses for child care in Minnesota are issued by the state. They're issued by the Department of Human Services. There generally are two types. There's family child care and there's child care centers. Family child care licensing monitoring activities are completed by counties. And there's about 150 county employees out there who do that monitoring activity. They process applications. They do site visits. They investigate complaints. But if there's a need for a licensing sanction of any sort, they make a recommendation to the department, and then we seek to employ statewide standards, and then we issue those licensing sanctions. That's different than the child care center arrangement, where Those licenses are issued by the state again, but the monitoring activities is done by state employees in our office. And so we have these two very different models, but and the standards are also a little different. So one of the things, there were some general themes that came out of our having contact with these provider groups. I'm just wondering, am I doing okay on time, Mr. Chair?
I think so.
Okay. We heard about problems with consistency consistency of licensing expectations.
Mr. Kerber, just on the time issue, my understanding is this is like your last item?
Yep, this is my last item,
yeah,
Mr.
So
Chair.
So you're doing great on time. I just wanted to make sure there wasn't four more that I missed.
Mr. Chair, there is one other issue from
this
operations area of the agency. Okay.
But the operations,
then we'll be done.
Think we're good.
Yeah, okay.
I think we're good.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We heard a lot about the consistency of licensing expectations, and we heard stories about varying interpretations by one licensor versus another and what was okay and what wasn't okay. And in some areas, that related to some of these safe sleep practices. And so that's very telling to us. And so we need to one of the first things that we have in our proposals is making it more clear what these expectations are for providers. And so that starts with us doing a better job of training our own staff. We used to do training, the state used to do training of new county licensing staff. But again, with budget reductions over time, we had cut that out. But that was a mistake. So we're proposing to reinstate that. We're also proposing to modify the training that's available to child care providers to update it. We heard a lot about how it's antiquated. We want to update it and improve it for the content and also make it more available around the state. We heard a lot about how there may be training opportunities in the metro area that aren't available in greater Minnesota, and the driving that people need to do is sometimes troubling. And so we're working on that effort here, too. And also to provide some of the budget proposal here includes some grant money for providers to help them pay for this training. And then we also want to, on that whole consistency theme, we want to use technology in ways that we hadn't before. We want to use the Internet to make sure that we have interpretations that are posted online. You know, license holders can ask a question about, you know, here's a situation, you know, maybe ask the commissioner, you know, where we'll have question and answer and FAQs and things like that that anybody can kind of turn to get an explanation of what is considered to be the statewide standard on that particular issue. And so that's going to take some work on our part, and we're going to have to make some commitments on some of those calls that we don't necessarily have to now. But that's in our proposal. Some regulations are proposed to be changed here too. One of them is we want to return to the requirement that had been in place until I think it was 2007 that if a family child care provider or any child care provider is going to deviate from the requirement that they put an infant down on its back to sleep, that they have to have a physician's order for that. That was in place and it got removed, and we want to reinstate that. Because one of the things that we think it'll do is it'll really, again, emphasize the significance of that requirement. It's a sidestep here. One of the things that we know about when these deaths occur, there's not been a case where a provider hasn't known what he or she was supposed to be doing. They didn't do what they were supposed to be doing for some other reason. And so it's the quality of that training needs to really help people understand how it's so very, very, very important that they do this and why. So that's where we're going with that. We want to clarify some of the standards just technically about you can't have loose bedding in the crib. It's a little bit more ambiguous now than it should be. On the training number of hours, you may have heard a lot about this. Right now, a family child care provider is required to get 8 hours of training a year. The mortality review panel recommendation was that could increase to 24 hours a year. That was a pretty significant increase. What we looked at was not trying to figure out what the magical number is, but actually trying to look at, well, what training should people have and on what schedule? And that kind of looking at it that way came out to about 16 hours a year. So it's not 24, but it is going to be doubling from 8 to 16 hours a year is what we're proposing. Some of those things would naturally occur from our changing the frequency of some of the training. Right now, for instance, CPR training is only required to be done every 3 years. We want to make that every 2 years. There were some people who had infants in distress who didn't seem to know what to do. They weren't comfortable. And the CPR training, what we're saying now, is going to have a pediatric component to it with a demonstration, as sort of a testing. And that's different. Abusive head trauma, we're making a change to terminology from shaken baby to abusive head trauma. It's in sort of a new state-of-the-art term. We want to require that annually instead of every 5 years. And the significance there, the relationship between that and infants dying is that shaking of infants is often associated with a provider of any sort kind of losing it for a moment. Not being able to handle the stress that is being presented to them with a crying infant, perhaps. And so that training focuses not just on don't shake babies. I mean, that should be a three-word training and should be done. But it's really about what are some alternatives when you're feeling really frazzled? What are some other things that you can do to better deal with that situation? And that also plays a role in some of these infant deaths, because we know that infants quiet down more quickly if they're put on their stomach to sleep versus when they're put on their back. Some infants don't really get as comfortable with themselves when they're laying on their back. And there may be a temptation at times to put that infant down because it works faster. And so not in every case, but that may be a variable here. And so we're thinking there's some benefit of that training. And then the sudden infant death. Now, we're changing the term from SIDS in this, because that's a medical diagnosis, as I mentioned, to sudden unexpected infant death. And rather than getting that training every 5 years, we're upping that to annually so that there's a refresher on that. Generally, when we talk with providers, people perceive there to be benefit of recurring training. And I was kind of surprised, because I thought more often I was going to hear that, why should we be expected to go have the same training over and over again? I've been doing this for 20 years. You know, I already know what they're going to say. I could give the training. But surprisingly, more often than not, what we were hearing is that providers said, you know, it's good to have these refreshers. And so I'm not sure what kind of comments you're getting now and what we're going to get from the actual language when that comes out, but it should be interesting. There's another one regarding infant checks. We had to look at some of the things that were different between child care centers and family child care, and one of them seems to be a requirement for checking on sleeping infants. In child care centers, there's a requirement that the infants are checked every 15 minutes if you're not in the room. And that and when you're not in the room, you're monitoring them with a listening device. So what we're proposing for family child care is not necessarily an ongoing requirement for 15-minute checks on a sleeping infant. It ultimately would be every half hour to check on a sleeping infant, but you need to have a monitor. But during that first 4 weeks that a child is in care, we want to recommend, we want there to be a requirement for 15-minute checks. So for the first 4 weeks, and then anytime if a child is having some kind of respiratory distress, the checking on that sleeping infant would occur more frequently. You may hear about that one. Some regulations need some clarifying. We heard a lot about how you know, sometimes infants fall asleep in other situations. If they're in a stroller, they go for a walk and the infant falls asleep. Are we saying you can't? Because the expectation is that infants must be put to sleep in a crib, in a safely set up crib. So what happens if an infant falls asleep in a stroller? Are we going to forbid that in our regulations? Well, no. What about if an infant falls asleep in a car seat on a ride? And, you know, are you supposed to wake up the infant? No. And what about if you're holding an infant and the infant falls asleep? Does that mean you have to wake up the infant or put the infant down immediately? And so, you know, the answer to these is no. And we're hoping to have some in the legislation itself to kind of structure that decision-making a little bit, kind of acknowledging that these things occur and, you know, you should put a child in a safe arrangement as soon as practicable, but you should be monitoring that child if they're not in a crib. They should be within your sight. The one about insurance that Senator, that you asked a question about, there we are going to have a recommendation in here that people be required to have liability insurance. Currently, family child care providers are expected to, but if they don't, they're required to tell the parents that they don't. Sadly, that doesn't always happen, and it hasn't happened in some of these tragic cases. And the connection between the insurance, the liability insurance, and reduction of infant deaths is a little bit more stretched, but we believe it's really related to the additional pressure, the additional accountability that providers may have to their insurer. As I'll talk next, we're going to be making more information public, and that if I know that my insurer is monitoring how I drive, I'm going to drive a little differently. I mean, we even have some programs to that effect. And so it's one more of these little accountability things that we have. And then finally, you may hear about $200 fines. One of the things that we don't need statutory change for this, but it's sort of an enforcement thing. There was a recommendation in the mortality review panel report that that people's license be revoked if they're ever found to be in violation of one of these safe sleep requirements. Now, certainly we want to take those all very seriously. But what we're going to be doing probably is issuing more consistently a fine. And the fines in this case would be a $200 fine. And we have heard a lot from family child care providers about how that $200 fine is significant. So hopefully they'll be interested in avoiding those fines. And then the last thing is really related to our licensing lookup. And if you've gone to the DHS website, you'll see that we have a lot of information about license holders posted online now. And you can sort by zip codes. So you can find providers in your neighborhood and your town and by facility type or service type. And for our directly licensed programs, as I mentioned, like for family child care and the other types of programs, or for child care centers and the other kind of programs we license, we have a lot of information up there, including, for all programs we have, licensing sanctions we have issued, but for our directly licensed programs, we also have correction orders and complaint investigations that are written in a public fashion that are posted online.
We've got a couple of questions, okay. And then I'd like to leave 5 minutes for the last item, which okay. is that expansion of internal audits, and then get to the public testimony. Okay. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Kerber. It's very interesting because I had someone this week who had been given an award for being a child care provider, got sanctioned for violating safe sleep, and she showed me the monthly form that she filled out for her crib environment, and it says no mattress pads can exceed 1 inch, but she got violated for having a mattress. She got the violation for having a mattress pad under the sheet, and the statute is unclear, and so I'm going to ask you, please, as you make all these changes, have outside reviews, make sure that forms match statutes. She's been doing this for 15 years. It's the first time she's ever had a violation, and she was in tears because she doesn't ever want to put a child at risk, and now it looks to the world like she has. And so, and it's a paperwork issue. She wouldn't have done it if her monthly form that she fills out every month had been more clear. But she takes responsibility for it, but I might be talking to you about that further. Also, could you please help me? Statute says infants up to and including 12 months of age. For these sleeping provisions, do you consider an infant up to 12 months of age, even if they're rolling over and things like that? I want to take a little bit of a look at that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, that's good. On the first issue, those are exactly the kind of stories that we've been hearing about. And you will see some language that's clarifying what the expectations are for portable cribs. And portable cribs are sort of their own unique kind of challenge. And it might not be in the budget bill, but there's also a licensing bill that seeks some clarity there. But it's those kinds of things that we need to make sure we have sort of internal consistency and then statewide consistency. On the age issue, the infants are, you're considered an infant until your first birthday. And maybe that's how we ought to talk about it, because it gets complicated, because we say, you know, 0 to 12, then is it 2 12? So in the 12th month, right. You know, so at the end of the 11th month, you're not an infant anymore. We have unbelievable conversations about this kind of stuff. But so the standard is that until your first birthday, you're considered to be an infant. After your first birthday, you're not an infant anymore. But then as it relates to rolling over, that's also one of the things you'll see statutory language about infants rolling over. That if an infant is capable of rolling over, the likelihood of a asphyxiation death is diminished considerably. And so we're not saying that you have to watch this infant to see if they roll over and then flip them back on their back again. Not. If they're capable of rolling over, that's not a requirement anymore. You can leave them rolled over.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Kerber.
Thank you.
We'll dig very deep yeah. into each of these as we get the language coming forward and have good discussions. And I know that I believe it's tomorrow some child care workers are coming in for the public testimony, and we'll hear from them as well, and we'll keep working. And there is, I don't know if you were here, there is some testimony that child care workers and other interested parties ask that we distribute in members' packets today. So with that, Senator Rosen, one more quick question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief question, maybe just a little comment. Mr. Kerber, the Child Mortality Review Panel, mm-hmm. was there daycare providers and the child centers represented on this panel? Because there are some major changes here. I'm hoping that we will have a chance to really get down into this $200 fee, not even a warning. That's pretty substantial. And the liability insurance, how much is that going to cut into the profits of some of these daycare providers? And I'm just thankful that all three of my children survived, because they were put on their tummies from day one. Right?
Yes.
And so I'm hoping that we take make sure that everybody's represented on these reviews.
Mr. Kerber,
there were not, and certainly we heard a lot of feedback about the fact that the Child Mortality Review Panel, as it's established in law, does not include family child care providers. And that wasn't the mission, but certainly we reviewed that report with child care providers. I mean, we very actively sought their input on these things, and it was very genuine. And that's why the recommendations you're seeing are very different from the recommendations that came out of the Child Mortality Review Panel. They're similar. The issues are similar, but we're approaching them very differently than most of those recommendations.
Well, and then on your question about numbers, when we see the fiscal note, I'll want to see the estimated effects on individual child care settings, you know, in terms of the expected costs of the insurance and how many fine of those $200 fines you expect to, you know, we'll be digging deep into those numbers.
Mr. Chair, not to make light of SIDS and infant
yes.
death syndrome or anything, no. It's just, I just hope the pendulum doesn't go swing too far, yeah. and that we are discourage the industry and the businesses to continue.
Thank you, Senator Rosen. We're going to move on to the expansion of the internal audits, the last budget item in the DHS governor's budget. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name for the record is Gregory Gray. I'm the Chief Compliance Officer for the Department of Human Services. To my right is Gary Johnson, who is our Director of Internal Audit. And the proposal in front of you, I think, is pretty straightforward.
For members, this is on page 65 of the Fast Facts and page 24 of the MMB document.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The proposal itself is pretty straightforward in that we're asking to expand the Internal Audit Department by 5 FTEs. But before getting into that, and I know I have 5 minutes, and I'll keep to that time frame.
Actually, you have 2 now.
Okay,
of Jerry.
Well, then I'll talk.
I mean,
it's not fair. And I did want to mention the fact that, you know, compliance office and OIG often get confused. 2 years ago, there was no Office of Inspector General. The licensing department was actually part of the compliance office, and it was the effort of our commissioner that we have a more robust effort at going after fraud is in particular outwardly looking at providers and the like, and that's why the Office of Inspector General was set up. Compliance Office is kind of the other bookend. If these are two bookends, we look internally. We look at what's happening within programs and at control weaknesses that might be within the systems and processes that take place within DHS. That in and of itself works in a complementary way with OIG. If we're doing our job properly, there's less fraud. And I think most folks understand that it's certainly more cost-effective to prevent fraud than it is to chase it after it's taken place. So that's what our goal is. That's kind of, you know, we're kind of twins in this effort. He's, I guess, I'm Arnold Schwarzenegger, and you can be Danny DeVito. but nonetheless, we do work in a complementary way, and we appreciate the work that Jerry Kerber and his team has done. Having said that, again, if you look at the Internal Audit Department, which is one piece of the compliance effort, currently we have 3.5 FTEs for, 11, $12 billion enterprise. And I think those of you who have worked in the private sector, those of you who have even maybe worked in other governmental entities, realize that 3.5 auditors spread over an environment that's as complex as DHS is certainly just not enough. And when I came into the department 2 years ago, I made that a priority, that we needed to expand what we do in terms of our oversight in the internal audit area. We have looked at a variety of areas that we believe are in significant need of additional review. And I think most of you realize that there are other entities that look at us. The legislative auditor comes in on occasion. There are federal authorities, CMS, the IRS, and others. But their review is very, very top level. Mm-hmm. And in order to really have an impact in terms of preserving the systems and preserving the integrity of these systems, we believe that we need a far more thorough review that should be done internally. And the only way that we're going to be able to get that done is by expanding the resources that we currently have available. So, you know, I'm more than happy to answer specific questions about the Internal Audit Department, and certainly Gary here is happy to talk about efforts that we've had in the past and some areas that we think we need to, in particular, look at as we move forward.
At the risk of sounding like a broken record, I'm going to go back to one of your comments, and I agree with you that preventing fraud on the front end is more cost-effective than chasing it on the back end. But one of the things I see in the budget proposal is that when you put money into chasing it on the back end, we see savings. And in this one, when you put money in on the front end, we see just the cost. And I will be looking very hard for the savings side of that to put on our bottom line. So just, and I've said that many times at a lot of these presentations. So, I mean, I agree with you that money on the front end at preventing fraud is more cost effective than chasing it. But I want to see that reflected in the budget so that we have that available to us. Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, if I could just have an explanation, understand that the 4.5 full-time auditors, or 5, it says on the spreadsheet, why the increase from 2015 of $170,000 increase to 2016?
It's right here.
Mr. Kerber.
What line are you on?
Well, I'm just looking at the fiscal impact.
Oh, you're just
from 2015 is 325, and then it goes.
Yeah. It goes up to 499. 16 and 17.
Right.
I think Roger said that was an error in the formula. Yeah. Mr. Chair, Gary Johnson, Director of Internal Audits. I believe Roger Ayersman, our budget person, said that was an error in the formula. And so it should remain constant across.
Constant at the 323?
I believe, yes.
Thank you. With that, I believe we are done with the presentation of the governor's budget. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Herbert, Mr. Gray, Mr. Johnson. And we will move on to public testimony. I think we're in pretty good shape. If everyone can restrict their comments to, you know, 5, if absolutely necessary, minutes, and we will start with Jody Harpstead from Lutheran Social Services, and I think we're going to bring up Bobby Cordano and Sonia Carruthers together after Jody Harpstead. So with that, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. State your name again
for us for the record,
on,
if you
yes.
would.
Chairman Lurie, members of the committee, I'm Jody Harpstead, CEO of Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota, serving neighbors in all 87 counties of our state, and on our 148th year of service to the people of Minnesota. It is my deep personal conviction that no young person in Minnesota should have to sleep under a bridge, ever, or in the woods outside of Brainerd, or in the parking lot of the Walmart in Mankato. The youth who show up in the youth services community in Minnesota have been abused and neglected by their parents and let down and let go by the foster care system. They need support while they finish growing up to get a foothold in the adult community. In 2006, when the Minnesota legislature passed the Homeless Youth Act, the youth community asked for $8 million in funding to make it work. It remains in the governor's budget today at $238,000. Youth services are some of the smallest investment, highest return services that I see in Lutheran Social Services, 23 different lines of service, and the least well supported by government. We're talking about John, who worked his way through our Renaissance Transitional Living Service in Duluth, started a career in sales, and is effectively parenting his little boy, Jack. Youth like Tony and Sarah, who I met in Mankato this year, who've received nothing from us but a drop-in center, counselors to talk to while they set goals for their lives, and an occasional free pizza. Tony and Sarah are both pulling down 4.0 grade point averages in college and on their way to productive adult lives. We are in a redesigned partnership this year with Catholic Charities, the Wilder Foundation, the Metro Youth Services Redesign Council, Youth Moving Forward, and the Homes for All Coalition to ask that Minnesota finally put the $8 million into the Homeless Youth Act to fund our innovative ideas to get the 2,500 homeless youth in Minnesota off the street, especially tonight. The youth provider community in Minnesota gets results. Help us to help our youth and to create new Minnesota taxpayers. 2 years ago, we introduced an innovative new design for people with disabilities in Minnesota called My Life, My Choices, which would allow people with disabilities to be able to design their own lives at lower cost to Minnesota taxpayers. We've worked closely with Commissioner Jessen's office to incorporate our design concepts into her Reform 2020 proposal. DHS will introduce the changes necessary to allow us to implement Reform 2020 and My Life, My Choices, and we're eager to get underway. So when she comes forward with that, please give the commissioner whatever she wants. It's all good stuff. On the other hand, there's the 1.67% cut to our current services for people with disabilities left over from the last budget session. We hope that a new biennium, a new forecast, and a new legislature will rethink that one. What sounds like a tiny amount would cut over $300,000 out of LSS services for 6 months alone, a major concern for us. LSS, Courage Center, and Fairview Health Services sponsored a design session last week to imagine ways to integrate social service and health care for people with disabilities. We need to maintain our capacity to go for the transformation that we're planning and not stop to deal with an enormous loss. We've already begun to move 50 of the 1,400 people LSS supports into host homes and technology-assisted living arrangements. Cutting funding for traditional settings just causes damage and does not incent innovation. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Ms. Harpstead. Next, we'll be bringing Bobby Cordano and Sonia Carruthers up both. I believe you're both with Wilder Foundation. Is that correct?
Yes, Chair. I'm Bobby Cordano, Vice President of Wilder Foundation, and Sonia is a parent of one of the children that we worked with.
Excellent. Well, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bobby Cordano, Vice President of Wilder Foundation, as I said a moment ago. Wilder is a nonprofit health and human service organization that has been serving families and children for over 108 years through direct services, research, and community engagement. One of our areas of expertise that we've actually been doing for almost 104 years is children's mental health, and that's what I'm here to speak with you about today. We would like to ask for your support of the governor's proposal to increase funding for the school-linked mental health grant program. And there are two critical reasons that we're asking for your support. Number one is this proposal will increase access for families and children to mental health services. And two, it will reduce disparities by linking high-quality mental health services to for children and families in the school setting. As you all know, the gaps in our current mental health service system leave too many children and parents without adequate access to diagnosis and treatment. This is particularly true for children with complex conditions. We know that the dropout rate for children living with serious mental illness is approximately twice that of other students. One in five children has a diagnosable mental illness, yet 70 to 80% do not receive treatment or receive adequate levels of care. The governor's proposal seeks to address this urgent need. Because schools are where children are nearly all day, this is where we see the mental health problems surface. And oftentimes, we see them in schools in ways that you will not see them in clinical setting and sometimes even at home. For this reason, the presence of school-based mental health service mental health expertise helps identify and intervene with conditions that could be missed. Wilder works with St. Paul School District to bring our expertise to the school school environment to support the school personnel, parents, and children to address the wide variety of mental health related issues that we see. The school-linked mental health grant makes this possible because these funds are combined with insurance reimbursement and other funding to pay for school on-site school psychologists, licensed social workers, and as well as school resource workers. The program works because it supports children, families, and school personnel in improving access, consistency of services, and our ability to provide culturally responsive, and now I'd like to say culturally centered services. I want to give you some examples. Appointments can now be kept at school, reducing lost work time for parents, driving to outpatient clinics. We know through our experience at Wilder and even in healthcare in general that if a referral is made by a school or the emergency room, only 20% of the students will actually get to an outpatient clinic. Among students with higher needs, 57% move to a less intensive level of care through the school-linked mental health grant program. Add to this, in Wilder's COFI program, which Sonia's son participated in, which is a program for African-American boys and girls is really culturally centered in working with our children and their family, we keep 70% of our African-American boys and girls out of special education. Many of the children with serious mental health needs were first identified through the school-linked mental health program. Another case in point, in our Lujong program, which works with Southeast Asian girls and boys, many of the children were underdiagnosed. In Lujong, we identified 41 children in the first 2 years of the program whose mental health needs were previously unaddressed. Increased access levels the playing field for all families, especially for students from cultural and ethnic minority communities. We know from the school-linked mental health grant program that 69% of Asian American students, 56% of African American students, and 52% of Caucasian students access services for the first time. School-based mental health services are only possible and sustainable through a combination of funding streams. Increasing funding to this program, as the governor proposes, will strengthen the infrastructure that we have been slowly and effectively building statewide. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I want to introduce you to Sonia Carruthers, a parent of a student who received school-based services in Wilder's COFI program, which is currently funded in part by the school-linked mental health program. Sonia?
Thank you, Ms. Cardano. Sonia Carruthers, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. I'd like to say good morning to you all. And this is my first time ever in the Capitol. It is a beautiful building, and I'm
welcome.
Very honored
welcome.
To be
it's,
here.
It's your house.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Sonia Carruthers. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today. I'm here today to speak in support of the governor's increase in the school-linked mental health grant and urge the Senate to include these increases in your budget. I know these programs work because I've seen it in my own family. I speak out the truth about my sad and my happy days as a single mother of three children. My son, Malik, had many days of getting sent home from school, put in timeouts, placed in other teachers' rooms from the school, and lots of unanswered questions. I have worked a career of 30 years this September of 2013. It has never been easy for my accomplishment of a very troubled son. I never ever wanted anything but the best for all of my children. I cried many nights to sleep, sometimes holding them in bed with me and trying to remove their pain, but only to have no one to hold me but faith. I heard from a friend that there was a program called COFI through the Wilder Foundation in the St. Paul School District. I have always lived in the suburbs of St. Paul, and my son, because of my work, he went to St. Paul schools, but not where the program was offered. I went to locate the nearest COFI school at that time, which was Gautier Elementary. My son wanted to excel in lots of things in school, example sports, basketball. He loves that. That's his dream. But because of the failing grades, the uncontrolled temper, silent times, and many days of rebelling against others of the staff, only to come home to a tired mother, but successful mother, and it was difficult for him. I knew I had to do something, and very quickly. I contacted Mr. Keith Allen, who was the COF counselor at the Gautier Elementary School. For Malik, the COFI program has made a great start, a new beginning, and a step in the right direction. The change came very slowly, but change is here still today. My son had failing grades of F's with no real cause, but I wanted to know how I could do and help him to be better. I just needed someone willing to help. And just myself, hardworking, dedicated, I needed more. So with people on my side, I knew I would have what I call now the dream team. My son started to open up to saying why he was upset. And we learned ways of sharing his feelings and turn his feelings into actions and goals and plans to make changes to move forward. His grades started to rise. Malik began to stand tall. His shoulders stood up high. And we knew then we were going in the right direction. We as a family, we begin to grow, we open our hearts, and we share the information with other neighbors and people in the community. Excuse me. My son started the program in the fourth grade, and he continued through the sixth. He graduated from school, and he also graduated from the COFI program. Not only with his head high, he had the biggest smile on his face with success. And me, his mother, with a happy tear, we made it. Malik began to get involved with sports and, of course, better grades, even the A honor roll. Right. Our struggles are still here, but the results are much better and greater. The program has helped our family to realize that working harder to get to where we want to be, it was just the beginning. We as a family began to use the knowledge and we shared it with many people of color with various levels of education, background, social skills, and most of all, determination. The program needs to be offered in more schools, even in the suburbs, because everywhere you go, there is a child like mine that is in need of someone to say, I'm here and we can do this together. This will not be easy, and we will achieve anything we need to if we just believe. I had the faith, but not the team. The COFI program now only gave me the team to do it, but they helped me as a single mom to help myself and my family. Others in the community, they began to ask me, where can I go to get this help? The help with my son, and now it allows girls to be in the program, which, because I have two daughters myself, girls need guidance too. I read these words to you today to only share my story, but to hope when I leave, my story will continue. Because our children are our future, and we as parents, single or together, we only want what is best for our children. I ask for your help today so that this wonderful program, like COFI, will continue to successfully help and change the lives of many other children and families. We are ready to move forth, and we need your help to make it happen. So, Mr. Chair and the members, please increase the funding for a great program and the schools linked for mental health grants. And I thank you very much for your time.
Ms. Carruthers, thank you for your powerful story of what these funds can really bring about. And congratulations on bringing about such a change in your son. I really hope we are able to find the resources to help many, many more families like yours. Thank you very much for the powerful story.
Thank you very much.
With that, we'll call up Twyla Braze. We are falling a little bit behind schedule, so we're going to call them up three at a time. Tony Carter and Judith Bloomfield are both from the county, so if you could begin to come up to the table as well. And with that, state your name for the record, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and I'm happy to come here today to talk with you about just a few pieces of the budget. Clearly, the budget's a very big item and many, many pages long. So the part of the budget that I want to chat with you about is the fact that I looked through the 275 pages of text, and I was struck by three things above and beyond our continuing concern about the funds to install the controversial government health insurance exchange that will share people's private information with the federal government, including the IRS and Homeland Security. We have long opposed the funds being used to create that entity, as you know. And we're not doing any handouts today, but if anybody is interested, this is the picture of the exchange as we see it and the sharing of the data, and it's on our website. So the first thing that I was struck by in the budget that I'm going to talk about is the $60 million for the statewide health improvement program, which will try to get the public to exercise more, eat less, smoke less, and eat healthy. And that's $60 million to do what moms and dads are meant to do and could do better if government weren't taking so much of their income to pay for the government workers to try to do the job that parents are meant to do, and to pay for those workers to then monitor parents and children's eating, exercising, and smoking behaviors. And so we have opposed that as well. The health department has 1,500 government workers. DHS has 7,000 government workers, with 2,000 of them here in St. Paul in offices. As you may have heard, government workers often earn more than private sector workers, yet I had difficulty finding anything in the budget in those pages that tries to shrink government, to give the working people back their money so they can choose the charities, the local churches, and the faith communities that they believe are the best value for their cost, including the use of volunteers to have a personal touch with the individuals. I also marvel at the $190 million for the health department's health policy division. Even with $30 to $40 million for clinical training, that leaves $150 million for research that too often has pushed policies that advance big data initiatives and government surveillance systems, such as the statewide trauma surveillance system of anybody who uses an ambulance or goes to the emergency room, or the mandated electronic medical records that gives the government and others access to all our medical data, or the mandatory e-prescribing programs, and the all-payer claims database with everyone's medical information in it. We have opposed those, and so we oppose the fact that they're still the initiatives are still being pushed and advanced in the budget. The second thing that struck me was so many of the loose outcomes. If you just look at the budget pages, you'll see that often the outcome is Minnesotans are healthy. That might be the only outcome. Or people in Minnesota are safe, or strong and stable families and communities. And I would venture to say that Minnesotans would not be willing to hand over their hard-earned money to anyone who had these simple, loose goals. But government officials may believe that legislative standards are much less rigorous, yet this is still the people's money. And I believe it should be looked at that how loose the goals are when you're spending the money. The third thing that struck me was the enormity of the federal grants. You just need to look at the list. So I brought it, and it's so you can see it's really small type. But if you look at the amount of things that are in here, or you look at the fact that this is it's just program after program after program that's funded by the federal government. And so I did a little bit of the looking at the money. And nearly 50% of what the Minnesota Departments of Health and Human Services do is funded by the federal government. And federal grants, as you know, have strings, requirements, dictates, and directives. A state can't do whatever they want to do just because they get federal money. They have to do whatever they said they were going to do. Thus it is though the federal government has its own agency within the state. And I would like to know if all of this money is specifically authorized by the state legislature, because there are several times over the years that I have seen the departments come and say that they have received federal money, they've started a program, and now they would like to get the authorization to keep it going and have it funded. So to me, this is sort of like the federal government gets their foot in the door, starts something, and then they come to you saying, well, we can't stop it now. So this list of federal grants tells its own story, and it shows how big the federal government is in the lives of Minnesotans and how much control the federal government has exercised using state agencies. So that will continue to be a concern of ours when it comes to the budget, the fact that all this money is coming in from outside, and I'm not sure that it has clear and specific legislative authority. Thank you.
Thank you for your thoughts, Ms. Braze. Tony Carter and Judith Bloomfield with the counties. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you very much. I'm Tony Carter, a member of the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners, and I'm here today in my capacity as first vice president of the Association of Minnesota Counties. I want to thank you for allowing me to make a few remarks and then to turn this over to Judith Bloomfield, my colleague, to speak on some specifics regarding the governor's bill. Counties recognize that the state continues to face a deficit that limits our ability, the governor's and the legislature's, to make significant new investments in health and human services. We do appreciate the governor's effort to target new investments to upstream health and human services programs that have long proven to save cost over the long term. I'd just like to make these few comments then regarding our priorities. The Association of Minnesota Counties has used an extensive process of member input in order to select our short list of priority initiatives for 2013 and the legislative session. The top priority of the association then in the area of human services and health is investment in the aging technology and infrastructure at the Department of Human Services. I believe that committee members here would be stunned to see the DOS-based system that people use to enroll folks in our DHS programs. I know that new staff members who come to us are really stunned when they see it. The rest of us had started living in a Windows-based world in the early 1990s, and more recently we've actually moved on to mobile, intuitive technology. But we are now finding that the work of human services is still being done in systems that may soon be worse than pencil, pen, and even carrier pigeon. So I urge you to support the governor's recommendation for investments in our technology. The Association of Minnesota County's second Health and Human Services priority is not in the governor's budget. We had hoped for an investment to draw down federal medical assistance funds that would help to cover some specific health care costs for jail inmates. Counties, you see, are responsible for 100% of these costs, and they truly are a significant burden on property taxpayers. We hope that you'll consider supporting initiative in this area as you develop your budget. Next, county's greatest concern with the governor's budget is the implementation of two new cost shifts that take money from county's budgets to assist the state budget. The total statewide impact of those cost shifts will be $8.14 million per biennium to go from the state general fund to county property taxes. Because of the cost shifts that we've seen in past years, counties are currently responsible for a percentage of the cost of care for patients in our Anoka Regional Treatment Center and in the Minnesota Security Hospital in St. Peter. The county cost share now for the Anoka Regional Treatment Center will rise from 50% to 75%. And the county cost share for the Minnesota Security Hospital will rise from 10 to 50%. These cost shares are applied for patients who have been deemed ready to go out into community placement. DHS estimates that about 15% of the Anoka population and about 25% of the St. Peter population would fit this criteria. Counties and DHS do, of course, share the goal of moving patients who are ready out of these settings and back into our community. However, this really is a complex issue, and this method of penalizing counties is unlikely to result in the desired outcome. Delays in moving patients into community placements are often the result of a lack of sufficient community resources and the challenging behaviors that patients can present even when determined ready to integrate into our community. For example, counties are struggling now to find appropriate community placement for convicted level 3 sex offenders and for undocumented patients. We do appreciate DHS's goal of using the funds that these new cost shares would raise for programs that will help to transition these clients back into the community. However, we believe that developing the programs down the road after the cost shares have been imposed really is putting the cart before the horse, if you will. There are other issues, clearly, that also need to be addressed. For example, the current moratorium that has been imposed on the development of corporate foster care options. So counties are committed to working with DHS to find the appropriate solutions that meet our needs of moving our goals of moving people into the community. We do not believe, however, that this cost share increase is the best way to achieve that goal. Finally, I do want to mention and to express appreciation for the governor's proposal to fund the infrastructure for a new outcome-based county human services system. Over the past 3 years, I've been working, co-chairing with Chuck Johnson from the Department of Human Services in the steering committee to establish this new system. So this small appropriation of approximately $750,000 per year will move forward 3 years of state and county and community cooperative work that has been focused on holding counties responsible for outcomes in human services programs. There is risk in this proposal for new counties, for our counties, but I am pleased to tell you that counties stand 100% behind the proposal for this new accountability system. We are hoping particularly that this new system offers future promise that will move us away from the prescriptive processes that we see mandated by the state and forward toward more flexible and outcome-based models. So with that, I'd like to turn this over for additional information to Judith Brumfield.
Thank you, Commissioner Carter. Judith Brumfield, and if we can make sure that we're not duplicative because we are running a bit behind. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. My name is Judith Brumfield. I'm the Health and Human Services Director in Scott County, but here representing, along with Commissioner Carter, AMC, the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, and the Minnesota Inter-County Association. We are in support of the governor's budget in many respects. We do recognize that the budgetary challenges facing the legislature and are interested then in proposals that really maximize our ability as counties to provide services within our existing resources. We believe this can best be accomplished by really three things: administrative simplification, utilizing technology to create efficiencies, and aligning funding with outcomes. We believe that any additional funding really should be directed toward those programs that can provide preventative services that lead to future cost avoidance. Commissioner Carter spoke about the importance of the governor's proposed funding for both technology and the performance management system, and we really want to support that without repeating any of those comments. With regard to administrative simplification, there are multiple components, and it's important that these be resourced so that valuable county staff can be dedicated to services for citizens in need. In 2011, Special Session Chapter 9, Article 9, required the Department of Human Services and counties to provide recommendations by January 15, 2013, to align program policy and procedures across public assistance programs. We are disappointed to see that there's no funding to implement these recommendations. Failure to provide resources to implement this is a setback. The fact that these are not included in the governor's budget means that it's critical, actually, to implementing the technology that is recommended in the governor's budget. So we would encourage you, as proposals come forward, to really look at this report and the needed resources in order to simplify the procedures of human services and therefore integrate them into a better technology system. Within the governor's budget, though, and looking at funding outcomes as well as funding services that are preventative in nature, there are several points that we really wanted to emphasize. First of all is establishing the North Star Care for Children Fund. This is very important that we use this in order to help move children out of foster care into permanent families. Research indicates clearly that children who age out of care in foster care don't do as well. We had earlier testimony on homeless youth. Many of these homeless youth are ones who have aged out of our foster care system. So that we have young people now between 18 and 25 years of age who have no connections. Again, the research in a number of counties with pilot projects has shown that equalizing the funding between adoption assistance, relative custody assistance, and foster care allows us to move children into permanent families, which are very important to their long-term future. So we'd emphasize the importance of supporting this. Second is we support the expansion of the Parent Support Outreach Program. Again, this is a program that looks at families who are reported to the child protection system but not necessarily meeting the level of need to come into that system. This diverts parents. Again, research on this program has shown that families who are offered these services very often do not then later come into the child protection system. We've been using this program in Scott County for several years and have seen that most of the families who are reported as potentially abusing or neglecting their children and go into this program do not reappear in our system. Again, a major cost avoidance. The expansion of the school-linked mental health program, we just had very dramatic testimony. The only thing I'd say about that, again, we have been doing it in Scott County for about 3 years. We've found that reaching out to the schools, having people in the schools, identifies children very early and gets them into a system of care so that they are helped. We have seen a lot of publicity recently about the school shootings and what do we do, and there are indications in many of those instances that there were early mental health unidentified issues. We're saying that if we begin to look in the elementary schools, the junior high, and the high schools, identify these children, get them the help they need, we may not need to arm guards in schools to prevent these kinds of shootings. A fourth thing we wanted to emphasize is funding to ensure child care for young mothers who are working.
Fourth and last.
It's important that these young mothers who are minors with children are able to finish high school, important both to their futures as well as incredibly important to their children's futures. So anything we can do to assure that there is continued child care funding dedicated to this resource is important to us as counties. So with that, I thank you for your attention. We're excited to see that there are some initiatives in the governor's budget, both to support what we do now as well as to look at how we might expand.
Commissioner Carter, Ms. Broomfield, thank you for coming forward. We look forward to fostering our partnership with the counties to make sure that our human services are delivered in the best and most efficient possible manner.
Thank you again
for coming forward. We have three housing-related folks next. Sharon Henry Blythe, Steve Horsfield, and Dan Kitzberger. Welcome to the committee. State your names for the record.
Just two of us today, Mr. Chair.
Oh, just two of you. Yeah. Okay, good enough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Kitzberger. I'm the policy director for the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. I'll keep my comments brief because I'd like to have Steve to have the bulk of the available time. But I just have a quick visual aid that helps to illustrate how we spend money for housing in Minnesota. So this first jar, I'll just preface this by telling you that these are our single-year appropriations. This first jar is for the mortgage interest deduction. So in 2014, we're going to spend about $330 million for that. The second jar is $28 million. This is what we spend on homeless prevention services and different kinds of supportive housing. And this last jar is what we spend on shelter. So this is a little less than $350,000 a year. Now, the governor's budget proposes about $700 million a year in property tax relief for homeowners. So this is what we have for funding available if you're a homeowner. And this jar is a one-time increase, about $1.5 million annually for rental assistance, and that's a one-time increase. So this is what's available if you are at risk of homelessness or currently experiencing homelessness. Now, as a homeowner, I understand the desire for some property tax relief, but as a Minnesotan, I think we need to do better for folks who are at risk of losing their housing or are currently homeless. So with that, I'd like to give the bulk of the time to Steve. Thank you.
Members of the committee, my name is Stephen Horsfield. I am the executive director at Simpson Housing Services. Our agency provides emergency shelter and supportive housing to families and individuals who have experienced homelessness. Since the recession, nonprofits, faith communities, downtown businesses, and local units of government have worked innovatively together to address rising homelessness in our community. Progress was made because of state funding for housing and supportive services in the Health and Human Services budget. We continue to be in crisis in Minnesota. The number of homeless individuals remains extremely high, and the number of homeless families with children is back near peak recession levels. Each week at our Simpson Housing Services lottery, we see as many as 100 men show up for the shelter lottery drawing when there are maybe 10 beds open. We've had as many as 125 families call in for one slot in our family housing program for transitional housing. Shelters in Minneapolis and across the state are bursting at the seams. I came into this work 10 years ago from the private sector after realizing that this service is not only a moral obligation, but also makes good fiscal sense to our community. Investing in housing and supportive services is strategic because of its returns to our community and state. We can spend a little on rental subsidies and case management, or we can spend a lot on expensive public services like emergency shelter, emergency room care, jail, and detox. At our 28th annual homeless memorial service in December, the average age of those Minnesotans who passed away while homeless was 44, as compared to the average of 80. For the Minnesotans we serve, housing is healthcare. It's a better way to do government services. Supportive and transitional housing are programs that work. Most importantly, investing in housing and supportive services has a true impact on the lives of families and their children. I'll end with a quick story. After spending a full year in the Hennepin County shelter system, Hannah, a mother of four, was able to get a slot in our family transitional housing program in July 2011. With stable housing and supportive services, she found a job as a cook and was quickly promoted to kitchen manager. Her income is rising, she's paid down past debt, and is putting money away in our savings program. She's getting close to her goal of affording a market-rate apartment. Her school-age children have maintained near-perfect attendance. Her oldest daughter is now attending MCTC with dreams of becoming a doctor. These accomplishments were made possible for this family as a direct result of relatively modest state investments. On behalf of the families, children, and individuals we serve, I strongly urge this committee to invest in transitional housing, supportive services, and emergency services in the Health and Human Services budget. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. A powerful demonstration. Next, we'll call Michael Scandrett and Jonathan Watson on behalf of the Safety Net Coalition. Welcome to the committee. Oh, the drill.
Handouts here, if we could have somebody help us with those.
We'll have somebody grab them. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Michael Scandrett. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Safety Net Coalition, and we're going to do our best to stay within your time constraints, but I want to let you know that the Safety Net Coalition is made up of a number of different organizations, each of whom could have testified, so we're trying to consolidate our testimony and limit the amount of time that you have to deal with us, but let's keep in mind that we're representing a lot of different safety net interests at the same time in our testimony today. Jonathan Watson is here with me from the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers, and to try to keep it a little bit more interesting, we're going to go back and forth a little bit to cover the things that we wanted to cover this morning. First of all, just to let you know, the Safety Net Coalition is made up of nonprofit organizations whose mission is to serve low-income, uninsured, and disadvantaged Minnesotans. So they really specialize in serving those who face the greatest barriers and challenges in their health and in access to care in Minnesota, those that are experiencing severe poverty, mental illness, homelessness, disabilities, racial and ethnic barriers that they may have. So the safety net consists of providers who choose to serve that population. It's a network of providers, in some ways a specialized network, that use unique models of care, who add additional services, who do outreach in the community as ways to reach those patients and communities that have the greatest access barriers and health needs. The coalition is made up of community primary care clinics, mental health clinics, dental clinics, safety net hospitals, public health and home visiting programs, outreach programs, and coverage programs. So it's a whole network of services designed to meet those with those special challenges. We wanted to say first, we really appreciate the governor's commitment and support of the safety net community in his budget proposal. We really appreciate that the governor's budget includes the expansion of medical assistance, that the governor is supportive of looking at the Minnesota Care Program and ensuring that we continue to have health plan options that are appropriate for low-income populations that do face additional barriers and challenges. We appreciate the emergency medical assistance continue to have some additional coverage there, but wanted to point out that it's still very inadequate for the remaining uninsured. Would like to talk to you about that at some point. We appreciate the support for the MERC funding, which is useful to safety net hospitals who have teaching and research functions and serve a lot of low-income and uninsured populations. But having said that, and we appreciate those things that are in the budget, we believe that a lot can be done to improve the budget, in particular to make it work better for those patients and communities who experience the greatest needs. Even with the coverage expansion, we estimate there'll be 210,000 uninsured people. And as Jonathan will talk about, we're expecting to see the uninsured probably be increasingly concentrated in a smaller number of safety net providers. Also, even with coverage, there's a serious risk that those specialized types of services that low-income and disadvantaged populations need are not going to be covered, or that the cost-sharing co-pays and deductibles will not be adequate for them to get those services. And also that we, as I'm going to mention several times, we are continuing to have underfunding of the payment rates for those providers that serve populations that have these more complex needs. It takes more time, it takes additional services, it takes outreach, it takes a very diverse workforce to meet the needs of the populations that have these most serious gaps in coverage. And unless we are paying adequately for it, all the coverage in the world is not going to make sure that those safety net providers are able to continue to provide the services. So the risk that we face and what we're going to ask you to address in the budget is that there's going to be increased need and demand for services from these specialized safety net providers, but unless the funding is adequate, that need is going to just put further stress on the safety net. So I'm going to turn it over to Jonathan Watson from the Association of Community Health Centers to talk a little bit about that issue.
Great. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Watson with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. We represent the 17 FQHCs in the state. We serve roughly 185,000 low-income Minnesotans. Given this is the Finance Committee, we serve about 8.2% of your non-disabled, non-elderly Medicaid and Minnesota care enrollees, and we do it with 1.2% of your budget, so it's a fairly cost-effective model. I just want to echo a little bit of what Michael was saying, just the experience in Massachusetts for the community health centers. The statewide rate of uninsurance did go down 50% in the state after their health care reform. For the community health center specifically, the number only went down 20%. So without a doubt, our market share of the uninsured actually increases under health care reform. I just want to deliver that message that we will continue to have uninsured in the state of Minnesota, and as Michael said, concentrated with the safety net providers like community health centers. So we do appreciate things in the governor's budget beyond the expanded access to the Medicaid program. However, there are some other pieces, some targeted funding pieces that Michael did mention, the Merck program being a good example of restoring those cuts back to the 2011 levels. But again, concentrating, focusing those two specific providers serving the underserved is a priority for our coalition. There are other grant programs, if you will, out there that were level funded, unfortunately, in the governor's budget, and we request this committee to take those under consideration. Some examples of those are the community health center funding, the group that I represent. In terms of we're really anticipating, again, based on a Massachusetts experience, a surge in our demand for services by all payers, insurance patients with various insurance coverage. Massachusetts, actually, the community health centers saw about a 25% increase in their total patients in the first couple years after reform. A lot of pent-up demand out there in the system. Once folks do gain coverage, they do use the community health centers. Other examples are the critical access mental health grants. Again, that's a very valuable service, critical access for low-income folks needing mental health services. Those are level funded in the governor's budget, as is the critical access dental provider program. That's a very effective program to expand access to dental coverage, which is still deplorable, unfortunately, in the state. And lastly, I'd like to mention, just in addition, the spirit of critical access, having a critical access payment for home care. There are some specific home care providers that do serve a disproportionate number of uninsured and Medicaid patients compared to statewide averages. So establishing that similar philosophy of a critical access home care provider is something our coalition is very interested in, and would like to have your a discussion with you on that.
Michael. All right, and then just in terms of some of our recommendations, and you have this in the handout that was provided, the Governor's Healthcare Reform Task Force did spend a lot of time discussing these unique needs of particular Minnesotans' populations that need specialized kinds of services, those that experience the greatest disparities currently in terms of their health, access to services, and quality of care. And so there were some recommendations of the task force that we would encourage the committee to consider, including some of these were about making sure that those safety net providers have the resources they need to implement some of the new reform models and tools, such as information technology, addressing workforce changes, doing outreach and navigation as part of the new insurance exchange, addressing coverage for the remaining uninsured that still won't be covered under the Medicaid expansion. And then I wanted Jonathan just to mention a little bit, too, about the quality measurement and dental issues.
Mm-hmm. Yes, just the additional three other items, just real briefly, is the quality measurement. As we're moving away from a fee-for-service to reimbursing on value in our healthcare system, one of the key components of that is measuring outcomes. And what we're asking for is a more apples-to-apples comparison between different provider types. Just our demographics alone, 30% of our patients don't speak English, 95% below 200% of poverty. We're just asking, as we have some more measurement in this state, that we incorporate social determinants of health into that outcome measurement. We don't do that very well right now as a state, and we're just asking you to allocate additional resources to make sure we have a very robust, what's called risk adjustment methodology and outcome measurement. Secondly, Michael alluded to the adult dental. Again, that was cut a few legislative sessions ago. We definitely have a crisis out there in adult dental. Waiting lists to community health centers can be in excess of 2 to 3 months to get an appointment. So clearly, having an additional coverage for adult dental benefit would go a long way to eliminating some of that. And lastly, I just want to speak real quickly to this emphasis on behavioral health care, which we applaud very much in the governor's budget. However, specifically for community health centers, under some policy decision that eludes me, if we provide a medical and a behavioral health encounter on the same day, we like to provide that one-stop shopping. We have that all underneath our roof at community health centers. We can't get Medicaid reimbursement on that second visit. We make that visit. We provide that encounter because it's the right thing to do by the patient, but unfortunately, it just is more of our uncompensated care. 26 other states seem to figure this out for their community health centers, and we're disappointed that this wasn't in the governor's budget, unfortunately, so we'd be coming back to ask your assistance on that.
All right, so just kind of in conclusion, and we will bring in some more specific recommendations on how to achieve this. So we just want the takeaway we really want you to have from today is that it's great. We need to expansion of coverage. We need the new reform models. We like that the emphasis on improving health. But unless we address the underfunding of those providers who are serving the populations that have the greatest need, we're only going to see a greater disparity as those that have fewer challenges continue to have more resources and improvement, and those that face the greatest barriers even in a worse condition than they are today. And it just kind of thinking about all the reformed discussion, wouldn't it be nice if the payments for care and the funding for care correlated with what it actually costs to serve populations that have the most complex needs, so you could actually get paid to do the things that are going to improve health and access for those that have the most disparities today. If we don't do that, what we will see happen and already see happening is the mainstream providers will refer their patients to the safety net just because they won't know how to deal with them. They won't have the resources or the expertise. The safety net providers are going to get more and more of those high-need, high-complex patients, and they're good at serving them, and their mission is to serve them. But if they have more and more volume at a losing proposition in terms of the funding that's available, we're going to end up with them being unable to keep up with all the demand that's there. So, again, we're going to bring some specific ideas for targeting those resources to make sure that we are going to address those that have the greatest need, and we look forward to working with the committee on those things.
Thank you. We look forward to that as well and fully expect there to be additional options brought before us for our consideration. Mr. Scandrett, Mr. Watson, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We're going to jump out of order here real quick. Tricia Stark with the Minnesota Psychological Association has requested that she be bumped up. She has another commitment. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Tricia Stark. I'm a licensed psychologist in practice in the community and a legislative chair for the Minnesota Psychological Association, and thanks for letting me bump up. I just have a couple of things that I'd like to say. I'd like to support the investments in children's mental health, as you've heard, and in daycare in the governor's budget. These are sensible and effective responses to the recent tragedies. I'd also like to support the increase in medical assistance reimbursement for providers. For some of us, it's been more than 12 years since we have had an increase, and providing an increase will help to ensure that there are well-trained providers available for children and adults with mental health concerns. I'd also ask you to consider, as part of the increase, to extend reimbursement for consultation to primary care to other mental health professionals. Right now, only psychiatrists can be paid for consultation. Other mental health professionals provide very different services, such as in the mental health area and in terms of dealing with chronic illness like diabetes or other issues. And because if we want to get serious about integrated care, we need to pay primary care and mental health professionals for taking the time to consult and coordinate care. Thank you.
Dr. Stark, thank you very much for your testimony.
Okay.
Thank you. Ann Kilzer and Siza Keller, I'll call up together with the Ms. Kilzer with the Minnesota Workforce Council and Ms. Keller with the Child Care Association. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity. My name is Ann Kilzer, formerly Olson, for those of you who knew me prior to July of this year. And I'm the director of the Minnesota Workforce Council Association. And I'm here today to applaud the governor's inclusion of funding for work study and paid work experience in his budget proposal. The Workforce Council Association represents Minnesota's workforce boards and the providers in our workforce centers who deliver the adult, dislocated worker, and youth employment programs. Additionally, most counties contract with these local workforce providers to deliver the employment and training portion of the Minnesota Family Investment Program services. Our job counselors work with MFIP participants to develop an employment plan, provide support, assist with job search and placement, follow up after job placement. They also teach soft skills needed in the workplace and give referrals to subsidized and unsubsidized work experience. We know that paid work experience is beneficial to our clients. It fully supports our and the governor's efforts to ensure that Minnesota's employers have the skilled workforce needed to meet the demands of our recovering economy. It has been an important tool for employment service counselors to use with MFIP participants who need a structured and monitored work experience to bolster their resumes and their confidence. Paid work experience is useful to keep people focused on the goal of finding employment. It provides participants with opportunities to improve their work skills while building positive work references. The actual funds are used for outreach and recruitment of employers, program orientation and intake of participants, testing and assessment, job development and marketing, pre-worksite training, supported worksite experience, job coaching, post-placement follow-up, and extensive case management and referral services. Paid work experience funding is a valuable tool that our employment counselors utilize to encourage employers to hire MFIP participants that may have many roadblocks and challenges that hinder them from successfully competing for jobs. Barriers like felonies, non-English-speaking new immigrants, and limited or poor work history are just a few of those barriers that some of our clients experience. As I mentioned, the economy is recovering, but as it does, we find that our most vulnerable and difficult-to-assist clients are the last ones to find opportunities in a still highly competitive employment environment. We did receive appropriations for this program in previous budget cycles. The successful use of this investment can be illustrated by specific examples. I'll give you two. I don't have time to go into all of the great stories we've collected, so I do have a handout that provides many more. A 52-year-old resident of a small rural community in southwest Minnesota was hired to work at the local meat packing plant. He worked there for less than a year because due to his fragile stature and frail health, he couldn't meet the physical demands of the work and was enrolled in the MFIP program. While on the MFIP program, this client participated in English language learner classes and began job searching with the Employment and Training Office. With the help of the paid work experience money, the job counselor placed him with a dairy farmer for an on-the-job training contract. At first, this participant did not fully understand his job duties milking cows, and he could not figure out the steps required to milk them correctly, probably not good for him or the cows, which was frustrating to the employer. But thanks to the OJT contract, the employment counselor from the Workforce Center was able to work with the employer, and they could both see that this 52-year-old frail man really wanted to work and was trying his best. The employer decided to give the MFIP participant another chance, and they created a new job for him cleaning stalls and bottle feeding the baby calves. This training contract allowed the employment counselor to work hand-in-hand with the client and the employer to give this man a chance at employment outside of the packing house, which is one of the few employers in rural Minnesota who hire very low-skilled workers. Typically, this employer would not have been willing to sacrifice his time and resources training someone for an entry-level job. Not only did the program open the door for the MFIP customer, but now this employer appreciates the hard work, ethics, and values of the employee and has been willing to invest in hiring other low-skilled workers. In Ramsey County, a client spent much of her adult life finding material success in the business world. She earned her degree in management and went up from there, eventually becoming a part of senior management.
Quite unfortunately, she experienced abuse in her marriage, drug use, and she slid downward, lost her job and her home. She ended up in treatment and on MFIP. She did not lose her skills, her personality, or her optimism in the process of losing her material possessions. She gained more determination and focus as she came to realize what was really of value to her. She began working with an MFIP counselor. She was volunteering at an inner-city Christian Ministries Life Center and at Breaking Free. She continued counseling and pursued training to deal with her criminal background. She conducted months and months of unproductive job search. She and her counselor finally decided that supported work might provide the push she needed to get a paying job. Through Changing Lives, a Ramsey County Workforce Solutions supported work program, she was able to convert her volunteer work into a paying job. After several months, she was hired permanently by Breaking Free when they received some additional grant funding. She successfully exited the MFIP program and continues to work at Breaking Free. Without work experience funding, it is nearly impossible to do on-the-job training contracts with employers. The regular MFIP grants can't be stretched to cover this amazing opportunity for our MFIP customers. It's hard to encourage an employer to just hire an MFIP client because we'd like them to, when many have so many more barriers and challenges that someone who has a more extensive skill or work history, no criminal history, or can fluently speak and read English. Furthermore, many employers are hesitant to take a chance on a new hire in this still tenuous economic environment. These training dollars offer that carrot and take away some of the cost and extra burden of training for the employers, making it less of a risk to take a chance on those folks who really do want to work but are having a hard time finding a job or an employer willing to give them a chance. Our colleagues at the Minnesota Social Service Association also support this funding. We encourage you to follow the governor's lead and invest in this very worthwhile program. Thank you.
Ms. Kilzer, thank you for the real-world stories of what this does for people struggling. Thank you very much. Ms. Keller?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Cisa Keller, and I am the Government Relations Committee Chair for the Minnesota Child Care Association. The Minnesota Child Care Association is an association of almost 250 privately owned child care centers throughout the state of Minnesota. I'll be very brief here, as I know we'll spend a lot of time on these issues this session. But I'm here today to express our support of the investments in the Child Care Assistance Program proposed by Governor Dayton. The goal of these targeted investments is to align the Child Care Assistance Program with current research that demonstrates access to high-quality care and education has huge benefits for working families, young children, and all of Minnesota. Wilder Research recently released a report that showed for every child that starts kindergarten not ready, it will cost the state, on average, $56,000 over that child's lifetime. And with 50% of our children currently not prepared for kindergarten, Minnesota will continue to lose $860 million every year if we do nothing. The proposed investments also begin to address the huge gap between the high quality care truly costs and what current reimbursement rates are. These investments make significant differences in providing true access for Minnesota's youngest children to high-quality childcare that will result in school readiness results or outcomes. We have provided you with a resource guide on child care assistance and centers, as well as the Wilder study, and we look forward to talking with you more this session. Thank you.
Thank you much, Ms. Keller. And for members' reference, the handouts that she discussed are in your packets that were available for you. Thank you very much. Josh Kroll with the North American Council on Adoptable Children. And I see Jessica Webster on deck. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for having me here, Mr. Chair. My name is Josh Kroll, and I am the project coordinator for the Adoption Subsidy Resource Center, which is a program of the North American Council on Adoptable Children. And we track the adoption subsidy programs in all 50 states, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and the Canadian provinces. So it keeps me a little busy. It also lets me know what's going on in other states. Today I'm here to support the North Star Care proposal because it's a good proposal. It's not a perfect proposal, but it's a very good proposal. We already heard from Ms. Brumfield about the poor outcomes for children who age out of the system, and those are very real and a very big issue for children who leave foster care from Minnesota's care without a permanent family, a permanent connection. But the other thing I'd like to highlight is that Minnesota has one of the lowest rates of adoption by foster families. It's 9.1% according to 2010 AFCARS data. That means that, and we have one of the highest rates of children being adopted by unrelated folks, which is either a relative or their foster family. So these children are being adopted by someone they don't know already, that they might have a situation where they might finally, after living in unstable conditions, they go enter a foster family, and that foster family makes the decision, we can't adopt this child because the support is so much less. It's less than 50% of what the foster care rate is. And the child may not understand, why is this family not choosing to adopt me, and feeling sort of rejected. Plus, the whole idea of, well, I'm used to how they do Christmas or Hanukkah or Thanksgiving. Now I have to learn how this other family does things. Maybe they have different food. So, you know, it's really difficult on the children, this disincentive to adopt. And Minnesota's been working on this for 10 years, and it hasn't happened yet. We had a chart that we did 10 years ago showing that it was about 50%. It's about 40% of the rates now. And, you know, it's something that we supported when Governor Plenty put out this proposal 4 years ago. We supported 2 years ago, and we're supporting it still today. And we really hope that DHS, or that the legislature, will fund this program, will choose to do this. One thing that we would like to do, and there is a cost to this, is to push for the legislature to go beyond what the governor has asked for, because the governor's proposal will only provide 50% to 50% of the foster, of the single rate package that they're talking about, to children who are adopted or enter relative care assistance who are under 6 years old, which basically leaves them at the same position they'd be today if nothing happened. There'd be about a $20 difference. And of course, there is a cost to that. And we know that the proposal that comes out is DHS is definitely looking at the cost related to this, but we really would encourage, if the money is available, to go a step further and make it a same rate for every single child in all three programs. And so that's it.
Thank you, Mr. Kroll. Jessica Webster with the Legal Services Advocacy Project.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm taking 3 minutes, so Ms. Weeks, you cut me off when I hit it. I'm here in basically partial support of the governor's budget as it relates to children and family services, specifically the Minnesota Family Investment Program. I applaud Assistant Commissioner Sullivan Sutton for really trying to improve this program, but legal aid would prioritize two things with federal TANF dollars that you don't see in the governor's budget. We would take these things in lieu of what the governor has proposed, and those two things are, one, repealing the family cap. Some of you have heard that referred to as the newborn penalty. For about 10 years, we've been denying assistance to new babies born to really low-income mothers on the Minnesota Family Investment Program. It's bad policy. We have bipartisan support, and we have pro-life and pro-choice voices. We have all kinds of advocacy groups supporting it in a broad coalition, so we'd like to see that. The other provision would be to increase the MFIP cash grant. We know that there are dollars within the federal TANF dollars that are unspent to increase the cash grant. We're keenly aware that there are limited resources. We think at a minimum there are TANF dollars there to increase the grant with a COLA that's indexed going forward. But I think you will hear that there are groups that do want more than that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Webster. Very efficient use of your time. Ms. Yili Yu with the Chinese Social Services Center. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me here. I'd like to have put forward some suggestions on Medicaid reform to reduce the waste and prevent the abuse.
Have you a handout? Miss Yu, it looked like you had a handout for a minute. He was going to come assist you if you had a handout. It looks like you don't. Sorry. Sorry okay. For the confusion.
I think we should reform Medicaid to reduce its waste and cover necessary services. For example, like restore emergency coverage, EMA coverage, and the dental coverage. The EMA covers those MA ineligible LPRs for those legal permanent residents, for those people who have urgent and chronic medical condition such as diabetes, hypertension, heart problem, cancer, hepatitis, asthma, whatever. No. Those illnesses who need constant medical medication treatment. Well, restoring EMA and dental coverages like a deep cleaning or root canal treatment. Please don't forget one important thing that I think that we should collect some copay treatment from these recipients to reduce MA cost. So if a state, as well as federal government, all need to take reform measures to reduce waste, prevent abuse of medical systems while not cut off basic services for the needed. The following is my actual suggestions. So number one, to ask all MA GAMC recipients to pay like a $4 premium, monthly premium fee, just like what the Minnesota Care recipients do. I think this can really can prevent some people like take for granted for free medical care. So the second is that we MA should faithfully collect like a $3 copay for office visit and a prescription copay, like a $3, $1 prescription copay. Right now, I think for past 2 years, it seems very chaotic. Some health plan, they collect the prescription copay, but for some other health plan, they're not collect any $3, $1 copay at all. I mean, that's I don't know, it doesn't, MA has more money or what? It seems just not consistent, yeah, very chaotic. And the number three, the ask all MA, GAMC, Minnesota Care recipients to pay restorative, like 20% copay for some dental treatments, like deep cleaning, root canal, and any endodontic treatment. Right now, from January 1st, 2010, there's no coverage for deep cleaning, for root canal treatment, I think at the back part of the teeth, and nothing for any endodontal treatment. Before, not covered for Minnesota Care recipients. Right now, from 2010, even for regular MA recipients, no deep cleaning at all. And even for regular dental cleaning, only for one time a year, not a regular two times a year. So we can ask recipients to pay the like 20% copay. I think that's before. That's before before 2003. Before 2003, the Minnesota Care recipients pay copay for deep cleaning, like a $48 for one quadrant for deep cleaning. But after 2003, I think the previous governor cut off all the dental benefit for the Minnesota Care recipients without the children. No dental cleaning, nothing. So until up to 2008, it seemed everything restored, resumed. So everyone can have a cleaning or deep cleaning, even without paying any copay. For those, even without pay copay, of course, the state will increase more financial burden. So for between 2008 and 2009, and then the 2 years, of course, there will be more burden will be increased. Then from now, all of a sudden, from 2010, all deep cleaning will cut off again. So it seems we are going always going too extreme. One, cover everything. On the other hand, no coverage. So so this is for the medical part. I think there's another issue, one big chaotic area is that there's no streamlined standard policy for elderly waiver program. So like as a senior adult daycare, there's so much waste in here. So some health plan coordinator kind of are very lenient, approve seniors to attend senior adult daycare 5 days per week. But some other coordinators are very strict. So it seems even not for those apparently should be eligible for elderly waiver, they just don't approve those seniors for even attend 1 day per week. So this is very chaotic. So we should reduce, MA should maximize seniors to attend a senior adult daycare like 3 days per week. That's maximize. And for those to allow senior to attend like minimum 1 day per week. So for senior adult daycare is good for senior to socialize each other. But if going attending too much, that's a waste of too much MA fund. And also restore EMA coverage for those people who have a medical condition. Right now, they just cannot go to any regular clinic to see their diabetes, hypertension thing. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Yu. I think we'll call there's five testifiers wishing to testify on behalf of the Welfare Rights Committee. Go ahead and pull a couple of extra chairs up. It seems like we have a smaller audience. Ms. Phyllis Walker, Deborah Howes, Deb Konichi, Angel Buchner, and Kim DeFranco. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and present your testimony.
Senator Lowry, committee members, I'm Phyllis Walker, and I'm representing ASME Local 3800, the clerical workers at the University of Minnesota. Our president, Shireen Horzak, wanted to be here today to address the committee, but she is on medical leave, so she asked
Walker,
me.
Walker, have you mislabeled on the
Yes, it's not. ASME Local 3800 has been supporting the welfare rights initiatives for about 10 years.
Okay.
We work with their committee, and we're testifying in support of their initiatives.
Excellent. Well, thank you. I wanted to make sure we hadn't made a mistake at our level. So thank you for the clarification.
Yeah. So Shireen Horzak, our president, is unable to be here because she's on medical leave, and she asked me to testify on her behalf. Our local, ASME Local 3800, represents 1,500 clerical workers at the University of Minnesota. Over 90% of the people in our local are women, many of whom are single parents. They're struggling to raise children, and they're barely getting by. If any of our members lost their jobs, they would find that the welfare system in Minnesota does not meet their needs. ASME Local 3800 is very proud to see that the governor's budget is designed to reverse many years of economic injustice in Minnesota, but the one thing it lacks is an increase in the welfare grant. Welfare is a working person's issue. When unemployment insurance runs out, parents who qualify for welfare are shocked to find that the monthly grant is only $437 a month for a family of two, and that it has not been increased since 1986. Welfare is a working person's issue because many of our members are just one job and one paycheck away from being forced to survive on welfare. Welfare is a working person's issue because welfare sets the floor below which wages cannot fall. Currently, the state of Minnesota allocates 0.1% of its budget to poor children and their families. In these times of high unemployment, it is up to you, our elected officials, to provide a reasonable safety net for the citizens of the state for whom there are no jobs. In our last election, working people spoke out. Their vote told us that they're ready for a change by electing worker-friendly candidates who are attuned to their needs, not the needs of the wealthy. We ask you to stand with the people who supported you and to partner with our governor and increase the welfare grant in Minnesota. AskMe Local 3800, the clerical workers at the University of Minnesota stand in support of raising the welfare grant, and we appreciate your support in making an increase in the welfare grant a reality. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Walker. Welcome to the committee.
Senator Laurie, committee members, my name is Angel Buchner, and I am with the Welfare Rights Committee. We're an organization that's been around for 20-plus years. We're also made up of current and former welfare recipients. So working poor is kind of our makeup of our committee. And we're all, like, mostly parents or grandparents. And that's kind of what our committee does. We advocate for poor families and working poor. And I'm going to just read a little bit of our testimony here. A very disappointing part of the governor's budget proposal is how it fails the poorest families in Minnesota by not calling for a substantial increase in Minnesota welfare cash grants. Welfare grants have not been increased since 1986, 27 years ago. Meanwhile, the cost of living has doubled since 1986. A cash grant for a family of two, a parent and a child, is $437 per month, the same as it was in 1986. Again, to keep up with just the cost of living since the last grant increase, the welfare grants should be doubled. For those of you who are new to the committee, welfare, called MFIP, Minnesota Family Investment Plan, provides cash assistance for families with unemployed parents. You can only qualify for MFIP if there are children in the home. Most people on welfare are children. No one goes on MFIP by choice. Even if the grants were doubled, most people on welfare would still be homeless. When unemployment insurance runs out, parents are shocked to find out that they still don't qualify for welfare because they are not poor enough. Going on MFIP means you have to go deep into the financial hole, and the current grant levels ensure you will stay in the hole for a very long time. But for the sake of the kids, families have to use welfare in tough times.
Good morning or good afternoon. My name is Darnella Wade. Have to say it slow because everybody thinks I say Donna, and it's okay. Darnella. I also am a member of the Welfare Rights Committee. I joined when I hit my 60-month time limit. So once I was done with the Minnesota MFIP program, I immediately joined an advocating system of people that are helping me state my position today. I have no cash. I hit the 60-month time limit 12 years ago. So I am a citizen of Minnesota, and I love my state. Actually, I want to add that. But the governor's budget proposal also ignores the millions in cuts to Minnesota MFIP families over the last several years. These cuts in the form of the family cap, housing penalties, sanctions, and the lifetime, and I will repeat that, lifetime and many other cuts have made life even harder for families like me in dire need. What the governor does not do about MFIP is less than a drop in the bucket. Or what he does do is less than a drop in the bucket compared to what is needed. His tinkering with the earned income disregard will only help a few families. When the grants are as low as they are now, we don't need tinkering. We need dramatic action. Another thing the governor ignores is paying back the TANF funds shift. TANF is a yearly block grant that Minnesota gets from the federal government for MFIP. Year after year, TANF dollars have been raided to supplant governor fund spending. Right now, if the TANF grant were used exclusively for poor family cash grants, it would almost be enough to double the grants. But instead, that money is being used for things that should be paid for general fund dollars. We urge this committee and this body to pass a substantial increase in the MFIP grants. The governor's budget fails the poorest of the poor. And we ask you to urge the Senate leadership to make budget targets that use TANF money for TANF families. Please, we ask you to do the right thing. For the first time in 26 years, increase the MFIP grants, or at least acknowledge how low they are.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Senator Laurie and committee. I'm just going to add a couple of things. I don't really have prepared testimony, but my name is Deb Konichny. Again, a member of the Welfare Rights Committee since the beginning, so over 20 years. So I just wanted to add that, because I don't think it was spelled out in our testimony, that the amount last year of the TANF federal block grant that went to cash assistance, the cash grants, was only 27%. We have these statistics from the DHS. The year before, it was 28%. This is how little of the TANF federal block grant is actually going to the cash assistance while families are being kept at 1986 levels. It just doesn't make sense. It keeps families. This is the TANF, the cash grants within MFIP actually put families at 70% below the federal poverty level. If you know the federal poverty level, you know that it's not really indexed to anything that reflects real poverty in today's world. It's way lower. You know, the true poverty level is higher. So when you're on a cash grant on welfare, you're at 70% below that incorrect federal poverty level. Even if we double the grants, that would bring families only up to 30% below the federal poverty level. So even doubling the grants, in our view, is not enough, but we see it as a place to start to make up for all of the years with no increase. The final thing I just wanted to say is that raising the cash grants is really the right things to do, and it makes sense. 70% below the poverty level puts families in extreme poverty. And remember, this is children. The majority of people who use welfare in our state is children. So we have thousands and thousands of children in what's called extreme poverty. The DHS testified in their overview that extreme poverty for children is the most adverse effect to their health and well-being. So this is affecting our children's health and well-being. What raising the cash grants would do, Minnesota's children's health and well-being, education, and potential will dramatically improve overnight. Overnight, having that cash in hand. It's good for the economy. When we are low income, the money we get, we spend and put it back into the economy. Homelessness, hunger, health crisis, domestic violence, and poverty actually cost much more than raising the welfare grants would cost. It will free up more affordable housing. If families in subsidized housing have more money, they pay more into their subsidized housing. Thus, there's going to be more dollars for increased subsidized housing, which we drastically need. And finally, it will help families get off welfare and into work much faster, because when we're trapped in extreme poverty, it puts families in a hole that's nearly impossible to get out of. It's impossible to look for work and find work, apply for jobs, if you keep losing your phone, if you keep losing your housing, if you're living in a shelter, if you don't have money for transportation. All of these things would improve the health and well-being of our state as a whole, because nobody is as good as the least of us. If any of us is hurting, the state suffers overall. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Seeing any other comments from members, I think that we've managed the time well today, and I really thank everyone who came to testify for helping us manage the time well. And with that, we stand adjourned. We will continue with public testimony.